Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As wildfires increase in frequency and intensity, California is trying to close the divide between its rural communities and essential communication services that they need during a natural disaster. Many may not have reliable access to the internet, a cell phone, or even a landline during wildfires, floods, or winter storms. So, some of these communities are turning to the past to communicate and receive critical messages when they're cut off from modern vital lines.
Extreme fire behavior is observed.
That's right. Two-way radios. CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd took a trip up to El Dorado County, where last summer's Caldor fire impacted rural communities along Highway 50. Scott spoke with members of the El Dorado County Emergency Radio Watch, a group of volunteers trying to fill the gap in the digital divide by relaying critical emergency messages to their neighbors, and discovered how similar networks are growing across the country. Scott joins us now. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, good morning, Vicky.
So, Scott, a 20th century technology in the 21st century to help with 21st century emergencies. How did you first learn about this group? Who are they?
Well, one of their co-founders reached out, and, you know, it was a story pitch that right off the bat, you know, I said, this is great, you know, because it's a group of all volunteers and just community members who've sort of built this thing up from the ground. And it's addressing, you know, this really essential problem that the state and other, you know, government from the state down to local level, they're spending hundreds of millions, billions of dollars trying to address, you know, how to anticipate and respond to natural disasters. And here are a bunch of people who are just sort of distributing these used two-way radios, trying to do their part and fill a piece of this void in the communication system. You know, as the state is searching for these high-tech solutions, here are these folks just, you know, doing what they can to build out this network. And of course, you know, as we're a radio station, we look for stories that we can tell that are, you know, sound forward. And this was one that was, you know, just sort of made for radio broadcast. So I said, yeah, let's do that. This is a great story.
Yeah, it really is, Scott. Given that you have reported on multiple wildfires across Northern California, including the Caldor fire, oftentimes in remote areas, rural communities, what did you learn about the challenges that they face when it comes to communication?
Yeah, communications in rural areas, just generally, on an average day, can be spotty. Internet is not always reliable. There isn't always accessible broadband in a lot of places. Cell coverage is not always very reliable. And so when you throw a natural disaster into the mix, and it can be a fire, but it could also be a winter storm or a flood, those already vulnerable communications, you know, can fail quite easily. And, you know, just one example, after the fire, there was a big snowstorm that came through the El Dorado County area and went up through Tahoe. And I spoke to folks who didn't have power, cell coverage, internet, or landlines for 10 days. I mean, can you imagine that? Like living in a rural community, and you have no way of communicating with the outside world, and you're buried under 3-4 feet of snow. So, you know, this is what a lot of these communities are facing. And why, you know, this, as he said, you know, century-old technology is so essential because it is reliable, and that's why they've turned to it.
So how does this actually work? You mentioned that these radios are essentially refurbished, right?
Yeah. So, you know, they essentially go onto eBay and they try to find these, you know, big lots of old retired radios, and they usually pick them up from police departments or fire departments. They get them, they clean them up, refurbish them, put new batteries in them. And, you know, this group in particular has kind of this, you know, tech whiz who sort of, you know, takes the lead on that. And the folks who put this group together, it's a smaller group, who are all like radio enthusiasts, you know, they're all into this, and they love kind of tinkering and learning about radios. And then they distribute them to the members of the group, and the other members, they're just kind of average everyday people. One of the co-founders described these radios in this group as radio for the rest of us. You know, you don't need special training to be an average member of this group. You just essentially have to understand the very basics of how a two-way radio works. And most people are going to be just listening in on, you know, the conversations that are happening from the folks who are taking the lead, who are a little more sophisticated, you know, who are basically delivering updates that they receive from official channels. You know, they're not delivering their own sort of emergency notifications or their own evacuation warnings. They're listening to radio traffic. They're monitoring any announcements from sheriff, fire, et cetera, vetting that, making sure that it is accurate, and then passing that along via radio to the rest of the group.
Which is critical and essential if cell phone and internet services failed. Are there any shortcomings with this radio system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one piece of a much bigger puzzle, a much, you know, sort of a very complicated patchwork. One thing is that, you know, these radios aren't very widely distributed. You know, for this group, there are about 350 members in El Dorado County, and they're spread out throughout the entire, for most of the county, I should say. And so, you know, that's not a lot of people. My understanding is, my impression is that as word gets out to this group of 350, you know, it can then reverberate further. Folks tell their neighbors, if internet, if cell is still working, you know, these updates come in and they're usually ahead of the curve of a lot of other forms of communication, whether it be text or phone calls or Twitter, and they can then sort of notify their neighbors. But yeah, I mean, this is a century old technology. And so, you know, there are some shortcomings with it. You know, it's not necessarily intuitive to work with, you know, a two-way radio. Folks may still, even though you don't need special training, they may not be fully understanding of, you know, what is involved in it and what goes into it. And there's also a certain kind of like radio etiquette. That's the best way I can describe it, in terms of communicating back and forth, that it's not like talking on a phone. You know, you have to be very concise, direct. You can't kind of linger on the air. So there are some shortcomings to it. And it, again, it's sort of a piece of this larger patchwork of, you know, the communications ecosystem.
Yeah, tool in the toolbox. I understand that.
Exactly.
It's 350 members, as you were talking about, but they're all volunteers. That's actually a pretty good group of people. Where do they get the funding and the money to keep this going?
You know, my sense is that they kind of scrape together these funds. You know, it's they buy the, as I mentioned, they buy these radios usually off eBay used, and then they will, you know, for members who join and want to have a radio, they do purchase them, but they purchase them essentially at cost. You know, the folks who are doing this aren't making any profit off it. Whatever the cost of the radio is, that's of the used radio, that's essentially what's passed along to the member when they purchase it. And then the member also has to buy a license from the FCC. It doesn't require a test or any training. It's a very simple license, but that runs about $70. So, you know, to be a member, you know, you do have to pay some money, and that license is good for a decade. So it's kind of like a one-time fee to get in, but that can be cost prohibitive for some folks. And so the group is trying to figure out what are ways to try to pull together some money, you know, whether that be grant money or donations from folks who want to see this group grow, so that people who maybe can't afford the $70 license, or, you know, the maybe ballpark $50 to $100+ for a radio, they don't have to not join the group because that cost would be prohibitive.
Yeah. I mean, it really is truly a community service. And I want to go back to when you were at the Caldor fire, because you went to the community of Grizzly Flats. You talked to people that lost their homes. Did this come in handy during that time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this fire started in a really dangerous area down in a canyon, where the community knew if a fire started down there, it could spread very quickly. And in fact, it did. And so I spoke to Eileen Strangfeld. She was a resident of Grizzly Flats. She actually lost her home. And she told me about those initial hours waiting up at night and just trying to stay as sort of abreast of updates as possible on this fire.
We could see the smoke. We could hear the helicopters. But we had no idea just how fast it was spreading or how big it was when it started. So we all just sat up and monitored what was going on the radio. We all had alternate routes, two main evacuation routes to get out of there. In listening to the radio, it was very clear that those two routes were going to be gone. We weren't going to be able to go out that way. So we knew that the only way down was through Grizzly Flats Road, which was a little bit scary because if the fire turned at any point, we were going to lose Grizzly Flats Road.
And, you know, that to me was really revealing, because it showed that these folks aren't just listening to see, you know, where's the fire? Is it spreading? Should we get out of here? It's a bit more sophisticated than that. They know what they need to do to get out, and they're understanding where the fire is moving so that they're making a more informed decision on how to get out and understanding what the risks are there, so that if the circumstances change, they have information to go on to essentially adapt in the moment. So, you know, again, a century old technology, but allowing people who are listening in to really make sophisticated decisions on how they're going to respond and evacuate.
But Scott, given that this is an amateur radio network, what do emergency responders have to say about this?
I spoke to Bob Hess. He was one of the co-founders of this neighborhood radio watch up in El Dorado County. And he said, you know, first responders, law enforcement at first, they were skeptical. Here's what he had to say.
We had a particular fire chief that just went nuts, you know, went to the county sheriff, thought that we were a bunch of ham radio operators that really didn't have a clue what law enforcement did. The general opinion among several, I think, in law enforcement and among the first responders was that we would create havoc in an emergency. We would start doing our own, on our own, issuing evacuation orders, resulting in evacuation routes clogging up. That's not what we were all about. I mean, we never ever said we would issue evacuation warnings, but we would forward credible information.
And, you know, since then, they have gotten the buy-in of, you know, law enforcement groups and fire and emergency responders, and they have several former emergency responders now on their board. But it did take a lot of reassurances, you know, from the group about, you know, what they were about, what they were doing, and convincing them that wasn't going to interfere with official responses.
Yeah. Scott, as we know, with not only wildfires, but just natural disasters, it can be really chaotic in the immediacy when people are deciding whether to evacuate and in what direction to go. So that could potentially confuse the public. What safeguards and protocols are in place to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, so they communicate only on, you know, a separate public radio frequency that doesn't have any sort of crossover with police or firefighter frequencies. So there's no kind of, you know, radio traffic jams that way. And as Bob said, they're only relaying official communications. They're taking this information that's already been announced by, you know, whether it be sheriff, OES, CAL FIRE, vetting it, making sure it's accurate, and then passing it along to their members. And also listening to radio traffic. If there's something about an update on the position of the fire, they may pass that along to their members as well. And for the folks who actually hit the button that sends a beeping alert to members, that does require special training. You do have to go through training to understand when to hit that button, how to be a bit more of a kind of sophisticated radio user. So these are some of the safeguards in place to make sure that this is, in fact, contributing to the more organized evacuation or response to an emergency and not creating confusion or interfering with official response.
Right. And as you've learned, it has been useful for people. And you also learned that it's not just in El Dorado County. Where else is this popping up?
Yeah, there are some others around the state. There's one, for example, in Sebastopol, and then also around the country. They're you know, in the Gulf states during hurricanes, you know, they tend to pop up. And in New England, after major storms, you know, every area of this country has a certain type of natural disaster, or maybe several, that they're prone to. I spoke to Joe Ames. He's the national chairman of Radio Relay International. And he said that interest in these groups really is growing.
The pattern that we see is always in response to large-scale disasters or catastrophes. With so many amateur radio operators in the country, there are several hundred thousand at any given time, you have a good chance of contacting the authorities in case you need help.
I guess with that, Scott, and everything that you learned from talking to these people, do you expect this just to continue to grow?
Well, the group up in El Dorado County has said that their interest in the group really did spike after the fire. They started this group after the campfire and learning lessons from what communications failures happened there. And when the fire hit in El Dorado County, you know, and beyond the Caldor fire, you know, residents said, we do need this. This is really important. And so they saw interest really grow. And then just a few months after the fire was put out, again, they had this big sort of walloping winter storm that knocked out power and cell and landlines to a lot of people. And so in real time, we're seeing the need for this. And residents in these communities are seeing the need for this. So just in talking to this group and in talking to other folks who have been involved in this amateur radio world, it does definitely seems like it's something that will grow in the years to come.
Well, thanks for pursuing the pitch, Scott.
Of course. Thanks for having me on, Vicki.
That is Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd sharing his reporting on El Dorado County's volunteer emergency radio watch group. Up next, California's Central Valley, a patchwork of fertile farms, but just underneath lies a history of racism and division. Up next, we speak with award-winning author and journalist Mark Arox about what he uncovered about his own heritage in his hometown of Fresno. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We've seen it in all parts of the country, and we have reported it here at home in Sacramento, Stockton, Reno, all over. It's the practice of redlining, where certain groups of people, African American, Asian, Mexican, Japanese, name your ethnic minority, are banned from owning land in certain areas of town. Some of those restrictions to this day remain baked into land purchase agreements. And while they may not be enforceable, those tiny words continue to have long-lasting implications on neighborhoods, isolating people of color and ethnic minorities, boxing them into certain areas of town, cut off by highways and freeways, locked into corridors, void of grocery stores, banks, schools, and other necessities. Through his reporting, author Mark Arox unearthed a dark reality of the Central Valley, specifically in Fresno, which is home to one of the largest Armenian American communities in the United States. A story which also includes his past and the search for justice decades later in California, a state which is really a patchwork of ethnic minorities similar to the landscape of the valley when seen from above. Mark joins us ahead of a lecture he will be giving this Saturday at UC Davis. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Nice to be with you, Vicki.
Mark, I'm from Northeast Los Angeles, and Glendale is a neighboring neighborhood from where I'm from, Eagle Rock, which is home to a very large Armenian American community. I was really surprised that also there's a large community in the Central Valley in Fresno. So if we can, let's begin with your history and your family story.
Sure. Fresno was Glendale before Glendale became Glendale. So, you know, I had a sense growing up that there was a series of dark, even cataclysmic events that had reshaped the lives of my grandparents and parents. But it wasn't something I was able to put into language, in part because my grandparents and parents hadn't put it into any language that was accessible. I mean, they were too busy trying to blend in and make a buck to survive in Fresno, which was one of the more brutal places in America. You know, I did glimpse some things as a kid. In the fifth grade, one of my classmates called me a Fresno Indian, and he started dancing in this powwow circle. And this mystified me. I mean, his family had come from Yugoslavia. They were immigrants like my family. But somehow he had taken a cue from the other white kids who considered themselves superior. I responded, you know, stupidly with my fists, and I got into trouble. And when I went home that day, I asked my dad, you know, why are people calling Armenians Fresno Indians? And he had no good answer. And so, you know, I think kids grow up dumb to the invention of their place. And as a child, I was profoundly ignorant of the forces that brought Fresno, the Central Valley, California into being. And I think children of migrants, immigrants, and refugees, more often than, you know, they also grow up kind of dumb to the reinvention of their family, this second act that grows out of the first act of dislocation. And then there's the place you come to, that place of relocation, of reinvention, Fresno. And it really, I later learned, it did its best to hide its secrets from us. You know, I went to Tenaya Junior High School. We were the Braves. We wore these maroon uniforms when we played sports. And our rivals were Awani, Wawona, and Tioga Junior Highs. But none of our teachers ever taught us who Tenaya was, what did Awani mean? My parents didn't know, I didn't know, and for all I knew, the teachers didn't know.
You obviously had some hint that something was deeply amiss as a child. When did you start learning more about that history, about that dark history in your family?
Well, when I was 15, my father was murdered in Fresno, and it was a crime that went unsolved for 30 years. And, you know, when nothing like a hole ripped into the fabric of your narrative, you know, inspires a kid to kind of pick up a pen and a paper and a tape recorder, too, and start asking questions. You know, what was Fresno? Who was my father? My father was Ara. He was a grape grower who became a grocer, and then he became the owner of a bar and restaurant that he turned into the really the hottest rock and roll joint between L.A. and Frisco. It was the first integrated nightclub in the San Joaquin Valley, and my dad did that integration, that mixing through music. 5 or 6 months before the murder, I mean, he had Chuck Berry, you know, the father of rock and roll. He brought him to his little nightclub there on the west side of Fresno, and Chuck Berry duck walked across the stage. January 2nd, 1972, you know, foggy valley night, he goes to work, two men from Detroit, it turns out, walked in while he was counting the New Year's receipts and shot him to death. He was 40, and they didn't take a single dime. My mom and uncles, aunts, no one had an answer. The cops had no answers. And so that became my journey backward, kind of my odyssey to figure out who we were, what had brought us to this place.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. That was such a pivotal time in the worst way. When you began searching for answers, what did you learn?
Well, I started with my two grandfathers, the poet, the priest and the poet. The priest was named Yerisha Mekaterian. And, you know, I went to him one day. He lived downtown, and I went to him with the tape recorder, and I just asked him, what brought us here? What was the old country like? And I'll never forget, he sat there silent for a minute, and he kind of grabbed and fumbled my tape recorder. And then he started chanting these names I had never heard. Bogdasar, Atlas, Noyomi. He chanted 40 names, 45 names, I think it was. It was kind of this dirge, this lament for the dead. And it occurred to me by the time he had finished chanting the names that these were all the family members that had died at the hands of the Turks in a genocide, the first genocide of the 20th century. He was the only survivor. And as the interview ended, he said, God saved me, only me. And then I went to my other grandfather, the poet, and he survived by hiding in an attic with a bunch of books. And after the genocide, he came down and he was greeted with these letters from his uncle, who had lost everyone in the genocide, his wife, his children. And he had relocated to the San Joaquin Valley, to Fresno. And he was writing these letters to my grandfather, Aram Arox, you know, telling him that Armenians had created a new Armenia here at the foot of the Sierra in this valley with all these rivers. And the grapes were as big as jade eggs, and the watermelons were so large that when you scooped out the meat, you could ride down the rivers and the canals in the shells of the watermelons. And so my grandfather took the bait, and he came here to Fresno, and that's how we landed in this place. And so thus began my kind of journey as a writer to figure out what was this place and how had it reshaped us and how had it reshaped itself.
That genocide that you're talking about led to a diaspora that began in the Central Valley in California. How did you learn how Armenian Americans were treated when they first got here?
Well, this was a land of utter violence. I mean, we had escaped genocide and we had come to a land conceived in genocide. You know, the genocide of the indigenous. It took three acts, you know, Spanish mission, Mexico's occupation, colony in California, and then the most violent act of all, the American seizure of California. And the land itself had undergone this violent remaking. I mean, this was marsh, the whole Central Valley. And, you know, in my most recent book, The Drempland, I tell the story of how the San Joaquin Valley is the most altered landscape by human hand in human history. And so who began that remaking? Well, it was these Confederates from the Old South and these plantation owners from Georgia and Virginia who had been chased out of the South by the boll weevil, and they landed in the West and they began diverting the rivers and draining the lakes and planting these cotton empires, wheat empires, and finally fruit and vegetables. So that whole Southern way of living kind of got transplanted onto the bottom of Tulare Lake. And then the Dust Bowl happened, and whites from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas came west, and they brought with them their own racial baggage. And so what you start seeing are these restrictive real estate codes that, you know, that start excluding Negroes, Mongolians, they called them, Hindus, Armenians, and then Mexicans. And, you know, it was right there in the real estate codes. And then this ended up in basically creating these ghettos where Armenians who are, you know, I'm light skinned and auburn haired, you know, but we were turned into a kind of racial category. We were called Black Turks. And so we were all excluded, all lived together with other minorities, and we were robbed of a kind of equity wealth. I mean, this went on for 50 years until the 1960s. I mean, my father couldn't play golf at certain country clubs. We couldn't live on a certain side of town.
There has since been some kind of solution, and I say that lightly because of the harm that was caused, the generational harm that was caused. But most recently, it led to the renaming of an elementary school in Fresno. Tell us what happened there.
Well, in the Drempland, I tell the story of this man named J.C. Faulkner. I mean, we lived just a few blocks off of Faulkner Avenue when we were finally able to move to the new northwest part of town. And he was a developer who'd arrived in Fresno in the 1912s, 1913s from the Midwest. And he had this dream of starting this experiment, this kind of turning the hog wallows and hard pan of Northwest Fresno into the largest experiment of figs with mansions. This was his vision, 12,000 acres of fig orchards and these exclusive mansions. And he was the father, really, of these restrictive real estate covenants. And basically, you know, they said, I mean, I could read one to you. It said, these premises in Fig Garden, no building therein in any manner should be used or occupied by Asiatics, Mongolians, Hindus, Negroes, Armenians, or any natives or descendants of the Turkish Empire. And the whole or any portion of this property cannot be occupied by, and then he went on, any Armenian, any descendant of an Armenian, any lineal descendant of an Armenian, save and except those employed as servants by the residents. And the very next sentence read, no poultry or livestock of any kind shall also be kept on this, these premises. And so that's where all of us stood. We belonged in the eyes of Fresno civic leaders, right there in the filth with the barnyard animals. And so here, the town, out of its ignorance, out of its refusal to confront and acknowledge its own history, had named a school after J.C. Faulkner. And so I started digging. My cousin, who is a writer as well, started digging. And we wrote this piece in the Fresno Bee, it was called Just Beneath the Dirt. And we explored this past and started connecting these dots and these pieces of history and telling the school board that you really can't have a school named after this man.
The name has been changed. What is the name now?
Well, it's in the process of being changed. There was a great deal of resistance. Even as we unearthed all this history about J.C. Faulkner, there was a great deal of resistance. I mean, the right wing didn't accept us because we were representing cancel culture in their eyes. The left wing didn't accept us because when they looked at us, it looked like we were white people trying to make this grievance. And yet that was what history had done. It had racialized the Armenians as well. As we went back into the past, we took on one of the biggest kind of industries here, which was the agriculture raisin industry. Sun-Made Raisin itself was founded on a campaign of terror against Armenian raisin growers who were refusing to sign up with Sun-Made Raisin Co-op. They wanted to do business with their own Armenian raisin packers. And so Sun-Made, really in a campaign reminiscent of the KKK. In fact, the KKK had a kind of resurgence in the 1920s. They started visiting these Armenian ranches and farms, with torchlights and stringing up the growers by rope and dragging them behind these Model T Fords through their vineyards, trying to force them to sign up. And this was the beginning of Sun-Made Raisin.
You know, Mark, I can't help but think of parallels to other minorities. I'm the daughter of immigrants. I can't help but think of my Japanese grandmother and my abuelos. Your books include a memoir of your father's unsolved murder, as well as multiple essay collections. You really draw a common thread between how people came to the United States and how these ethnic groups were treated here, and you continue to chip away at this. On Saturday, you're going to host a lecture at UC Davis. What will you be discussing, and how can people participate?
Well, we'll be discussing this past. I mean, it wasn't just Armenian raisin growers. It was Japanese raisin growers who were targeted as well for the very same reasons. And yes, you know, I have felt very comfortable throughout my career as a writer and journalist to cross ethnic and racial lines and go tell the story of others. And, you know, I told the story of the Boys of McFarland, which inspired that movie. I found these colonies, the last survivors, the Black Okies, who came west and followed the cotton trail to pick the cotton of those southern plantation owners. And, I recorded 200 hours of their oral histories. They were living outside of even these small towns because they were excluded from living inside them. This has been, you know, kind of my career, finding these connections in the narrative, because all of us started off here as migrants and immigrants who dug our knees into the soil and started picking the crops of this place. So that's what we'll be talking about at UC Davis.
Mark, thank you so much for taking the time.
Vicki, thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me to speak on a bit about all this. It's a complicated subject.
It's very important. That is author and journalist Mark Arox. Mark will be speaking at UC Davis on Saturday, and we have information on our Insight page at capradio.org. Still ahead, the Sacramento folk trio Dear Darling joins us ahead of the release of their debut album. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Just before the pandemic, three women met by chance and formed a connection that created Dear Darling. They came up with the name of the band just a few days before their first performance in January of 2020. The women all come from different musical backgrounds, classical, jazz, and musical theater, and have created a conglomerate of sweet, folksy melodies. The trio released their first song in October of 2020 and are about to release their first album titled Believe, which is also the name of their first single. The song has themes of self-empowerment, unconditional love, and following your dreams. Dear Darling joins us now to talk about their debut album. Casey Lipko, who's bass and voice, as well as Natalie Hagwood, cello and voice as well. Welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Vicky. Happy to be here.
This is a pretty big moment, Casey.
It is a big moment. It is a culmination of us as a group, as individuals. We're putting our music out there formally, and it is our formal introduction to the world as Dear Darling. It's so exciting.
Yeah. I mean, Natalie, it's like kind of from a caterpillar to a butterfly, given you released your first single amid the pandemic in October of 2020, and now you're releasing a debut album. You know, what has that process been like?
It's been really special. It's been neat to walk through the hurdles of being a band in a pandemic together, supporting one another in the ups and downs, and it feels so exciting to finally get this music out into the world.
What are some of the themes of your upcoming album?
Oh, you named them so beautifully in your introduction. We sing about friendship, we sing about vulnerability, empowering and uplifting one another. And there's also some spunky, fun, some sassiness in our music as well.
I would imagine, Casey, that, you know, the three of you met by chance, and now you're more than just a folk trio, right? I would imagine there's a great deal of bonding and relationships that come with this over the last, you know, 2 years.
Yeah, definitely. We have experienced a lot of life together and navigated through many different things, especially creating this album project, which is it's been a dream to work with both of them, both Hannah and Natalie. And the beautiful thing about this group is, you know, I adore both of them as musicians and human beings.
How do you want listeners to feel when they take in your music?
Wow, that is a great question. I hope they take in wherever they're at and just have their own experience with the music. We've created it for you.
Well, Casey, let's get to the first song. If you want to introduce the first track, what's the story behind Who Cares?
Oh, this is a sassy one. This is what Natalie was mentioning. This is a song, you know, as musicians we encounter, and, you know, people in general, but I'd say often as musicians and female musicians, we encounter a lot of criticism. So this is our response to that.
Who cares if you don't like me? I love myself. Who cares if you don't like me? I love myself. Who cares if you don't like me? I love myself. Who cares if you don't like me? I love myself. Say I'm too nice, I'm too city, I got style, I'm too pretty, I take up space, I'm too loud, I'm well read, I'm too proud. You go your way and I go mine, I don't need to waste my time. I hear what you got to say, but watch me as I walk away.
That is sweet, sassy, and soulful. I imagine myself, you know, listening to that before maybe going on stage or even for like a job interview or something. Natalie, let's talk about the next track. It is called Sing a Song.
This song is a celebration of friendship between the three of us. And you're so right. We are so much more than a band. We are dear, dear friends. And this was a song that is about the friendship we share no matter what comes our way, even long distance in our band. At the time, I was potentially going to be living in Texas. So there's a line in the song that says, I'd fly to Texas, drive to LA, I'd make it happen even if you're far away. And we've really stayed true to that commitment to one another, even when distance and separates us.
Song with you, to sing a song with you. Da 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 da. I'd fly to Texas, drive to LA. I'd make it happen even if you're far away. There's nothing I'd rather do than to sing a song with you. Sing a song with you.
I wish you could see what's happening right now. Everybody is dancing on Zoom boxes. Even our audio engineer, Chris, is bobbing his head. It's a great song.
It's a dance party over here.
It is a dance party. I'm bouncing around too. Well, Casey, we have one more. This is actually the title track of the debut album, Believe.
Yes, Believe. That's the first song we released. You mentioned that in 2020. And here we are almost two years later, releasing the album. And it is titled Believe. So this is the title track. And this is a special one to us. It is a song about uplifting others, and often in the group. You know, one of the lines in the song is, believe in yourself the way I believe in you. And so often we can see the beauty and talent in others. And so this is a song about shining a spotlight on that so that person can see it in themselves.
Walking along the sun-paved road, find myself far from home, chasing dreams and following my plans. Soles of my shoes are wearing thin. I don't think anyone's listening. If they did, they'd understand. Keep some of the good for yourself. Hold on to all the good that's left.
I'm listening to this song, going back to how all this culminated with a chance encounter in 2020. And now look at the three of you. I know that Hannah can't be here, but you, Casey and Natalie, and now you all are going on a cruise. You're actually going to be playing on a cruise now. Thinking about all that work that led to this moment. Tell us about your upcoming trip.
Yeah, we have, there's kind of a lot going on for us in the next couple of weeks. Officially, our album drops tomorrow on March 11th, which is so exciting. And then on Saturday, March 12th, we have a live stream concert. So you can find information about that. We call it a Bon Voyage concert because on Monday we're heading out to Miami.
Wow.
In November, we won a competition for a spot on this week-long cruise traveling through the Caribbean, playing alongside Emmylou Harris, the Punch Brothers, Grace Potter, and more. So it is quite ascending off of our debut album.
You know, it's kind of like a tour, except it's on the water. It's like your first tour of sorts, right, Natalie?
Yes, and all three of us have never been on a cruise, so it'll be a first in many ways. And you can find the link to our live stream concert and our album on our website, deardarlingmusic.com.
And we're making it easy, too. We have a link on our Insight page at Cap Radio as well. Before we send you off, we're going to end with the song You're Not Welcome Here, but I would love if one of you can just explain what the song means.
Now, we'll tag team this because it involves a lot of Post-its. So, Natalie,
Post-its, okay.
So, it definitely is a contrary title to what you think we stand for. But what we're addressing when we say you're not welcome here is actually the unwanted inner critic. When those inner critic sabotaging voices start talking. And this was a really neat experiment for all of us. We all wrote on little Post-it notes the inner critic voice that comes up for us. And we used those voices to write a response to that inner critic in saying, you're not welcome here.
Casey, do you have anything to add?
That Natalie pretty much summed it up. It was an interesting experience writing down inner critical thoughts and putting them on a whiteboard in front of the group as Dear Darling. That for me was an interesting experience to actually see the voice in your head written down in front of you, and also other critical voices, you know, of Natalie and Hannah. And then for us to look at, there was some overlap and some parallel in some of the things we were writing, which was a little bit weird, but also made sense. So
personally, I think when I get stuff like that out, it's not as scary when you look at it.
You're right. Yes. Yeah.
It was neat to know we weren't alone in those thoughts. If you're not good enough, you're not this, you're too this. It was really uplifting to see we all have those sabotaging voices that hold us back.
Yeah. That is Casey Lipka and Natalie Hagwood. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Congratulations. Have a great time.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
And Casey and Natalie, as well as Hannah Kyle, are the Sacramento folk trio Dear Darling. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday. And here is more of the song from Dear Darling, You're Not Welcome Here.